from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello, and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Sharon Gamble. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buselli Wallerap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Travis DiNicola. Today I'll find out about a special program for poets at the new Eskenazi Hospital.
I'll have a look at the new exhibit of works by Georgia O'Keeffe and her contemporaries at the IMA.
And I'll find out how the Benjamin Harrison Presidential Site is celebrating the holidays. Plus, there'll be that arts calendar we call
What Do We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. The new Sidney and Lois Eskenazi Hospital, part of Eskenazi Health, has many features you might not expect to find at a hospital, like their art collection, outdoor water feature, or their rooftop garden. And, you ready? They also have poets. Travis DiNicola spoke with local poets Mitchell Douglas and Adam Hens about their participation in what Eskenazi calls the Healing Project.
Adam, Mitchell, welcome to Art of the Matter. Great to see you guys here today.
Thank you for having me, Travis.
Thanks so much for having us.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I mean, over the summer, I got to see you both read your work and perform at the opening at Eskenazi Hospital of the outdoor community area, and it was great. I mean, that was just such a cool day, anyway. And,
yeah,
right.
You know, it's gorgeous space and great performances that were going on throughout the day. But and it was really there that day that I first learned about this project at Eskenazi involving poets, and it's really cool. Tell me a bit about it as far as how each of you got involved with it. Mitchell, you want to start?
Sure. I was working with a local architect down at Sink on the Indianapolis Cultural Trail bus shelter project, that Moving Forward project that she did, the eco-friendly bus shelters that have local poets with poems on them and Minds Below the Arts Garden.
Okay.
She referred me to Michael Kaufman, and Michael works with Health and Hospital Corporation of Marion County.
Mm-hmm.
We started to talk about, you know, the project, and
yeah, Michael's done some really interesting things with Eskenazi in terms of, you know, programming art and music and poetry as part of all that.
Okay. Right. So Michael was really was really great to kind of, you know, talk with him about what was going to be involved with the project. And I thought what was really cool is that it was this idea of art being a part of healing, you know, and I thought about that, and I thought about, you know, having a poem that would be in the Healing Waters Fountain. And I was like, this is going to be a permanent display, you know, that my poems would be in, you know, and I was just kind of like, there was no way that I couldn't, you know, be a part of that. So I wanted to write a poem, present it, you know, to Michael, and you know, see if they would be interested in using my work.
Describe for me, if you will, the Healing Waters Fountain, because it's an amazing sort of outdoor sculptural piece.
Right. It's a great it's a great space. It's part of the common ground area of the hospital. So right before you walk into the hospital entrance, you see the fountain, you know, just kind of laid out there. The beautiful thing for it for me, you were talking about the ribbon cutting over the summer, is that kids were playing in the fountain there, you know.
So cool to see.
So it was kind of like, you know, this is a space that, you know, people come there, the community can use it. It really kind of sends this message that we're all, you know, I think we all deserve, you know, this kind of, you know, treatment in terms of, you know, recovery and healthcare. I think it's really important. And so you'll see a line from the poem next to the fountain. And as the water drains away, more of the words of the poem are revealed. And so that part of it, too, I thought, well, you know, that's pretty incredible.
Yeah,
I just wanted to see what that would look like.
It's absolutely gorgeous. And the fountain, you know, it's not really enclosed. It's open. As you said, you know, kids were playing in it at the opening. People were pushing little, you know, paper sailboats through it. And it encourages you, actually, sort of, if you want to, get your feet wet.
I think so. And I love that, you know, the kids were there and nobody was like, oh, you have to go away. It's like that was part of it. People were using it exactly the way that it was intended.
Yeah, so very welcoming.
That was great. Yeah.
Adam, how about about you?
Well, I was approached by a friend, Joseph Allen Woods. I know more by his stage name, Allen Imagery. And he said that he'd been working with Eskenazi. Mm-hmm. And he told me about the Healing Project. And what we're doing is we're basically he asked me to craft a poem about confronting illness and, you know, like, you know, accepting your limitations and kind of just kind of viewing health from a holistic standpoint. And he said that they were making videos for the patients at Eskenazi so that they could watch them, you know, in their rooms and stuff like that. And it just sounded like the coolest project. And he approached me right when I was starting a kind of intensive doctoral program. And he said, do you have time for it? And I was just like, I was kind of like Mitchell. I was like, I think I have to have time for for this. And so I made time for it to happen. And I wrote the poem, and we just filmed the last little bit. We filmed around the IMA, we filmed downtown, and so I have not seen the video yet, but I'm really excited to. So maybe the patients will see it before I do, but maybe I'll get to see it soon. I'm not sure.
That's really cool. So now the video that's shown in people's rooms, if they want to watch this, it includes numerous poets, right?
Yeah. So Tony Styx, January York, Hadi Ra, these are all poets from the local community, from the Indianapolis community.
Yeah.
And, you know, we appreciate diversity as far as, you know, like race and gender and age. And we try to get a good mix of different people and different voices. And it was just a really special program to be involved in. I was really proud of it.
Now, you were at IU working on your doctorate, right?
Mm-hmm.
This actually connected to your research in some way.
Yeah, a little bit. So I am in the Literacy, Culture, and Language Education Department. I'm studying critical literacy. So my what I do is I help organizations set up literacy communities. So I've been to we just had a workshop at the Indiana Women's Prison over the summer. I've been to different schools. We used to have a program at Arsenal Tech and at Arlington a few years ago. I also work with a program called Voices, Voicing Our Issues and Concerns and Through Expression of Self, and that is a Indianapolis-based nonprofit organization. We go around to different schools. We work with Renaissance High School. So I just love reading. I study all types of different texts like poetry and hip hop and graphic novels and video games. And I love going to, you know, different places and just talking to young people about what they love to read.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Now, Mitchell, you said you had been involved with the bus shelter project before. Had you been involved in any other type of this sort of interesting combination of, for you, it's both sort of public art plus kind of art therapy. Is this kind of a new thing for you in terms of your work?
The public art thing is very new for me. I think I first came to Indianapolis in 2006, and my colleagues here at IUPUI and local arts community kind of welcomed me from the beginning. I was doing a Etheridge Knight tribute at the Chatterbox on Mass Ave.
Yeah, like, nice.
Before I could, you know, like, you know, blink and actually, you know, sit down, which was great, which I loved that. And so there's always been, I've always really felt welcomed here in terms of, you know, the arts community. But in terms of public art, this is the Moving Forward project with the Cultural Trail was the first opportunity for me. And then when I thought about the opportunity with the Eskenazi project, I was like, well, this is something that that I have to be involved in, and I was really, really excited about.
I mean, this is a pretty unique project. I mean, both you guys are published authors, your instructors. Again, you know, Adam, you're at IU, Mitchell, you're at IUPUI. You know, I mean, this is kind of a unique opportunity. I mean, you know, when you talk about this with your students, I mean, how do you sort of explain it? I mean, you're like, oh, yeah, every poet gets to have their work at a hospital, right?
that's what you would hope, I think. But I think these are examples that, you know, art really is for healing on so many different levels. And I think it's something that we can share in. It's something that, you know, it could connect with our common experience. And I think, you know, just walking by this and say, oh, yeah, I was at that fountain. You know, and you share that, you know, experience of being there with someone else, you know, then there's that connection. And it's not something that's, you know, I think it's so much different than, you know, than a book, you know, and something that's, you know, tucked away. And maybe everybody won't see it because maybe the book won't get, you know, in all these different places. But, you know, a fountain is there. It's, you know, that space is there. The facility is there to welcome you. And you can be a part of that.
That's pretty cool. Yeah.
For me, it's my high school students. When I go and visit different locations, you know, I perform poetry for them. But mostly my university students, it's like Clark Kent and Superman. Like I have my poetry alter ego. And I remember last year in my public speaking class, one of my students Googled me and they found this poetry and they actually put one of my poems in their presentation. I was so red because that's kind of part of my life that I don't always share. So for this time, I told my students that I was going to miss class today because I had to come all the way to Indianapolis. And so they're all excited about hearing the podcast and,
cool.
and stuff like
that's
that.
Cool.
Yeah.
That's
but going back off something that Mitchell said, like, I think that our job is to show people that poetry is relevant, that there's poetry all around us, and projects like this really, really prove that, you know, whether you see a poem at a bus stop, like one of Mitchell's poems, or whether you see one of our poems, you know, on TV at Eskenazi, you know, with, you know, this like rapid growth of technology and globalization, you know, there's more opportunities for poetry to be seen all around us. And I think that's a really cool thing.
That's a very cool thing. Yeah. And I have to say, I mean, just what Eskenazi has done has been pretty amazing. I mean, not just having the poetry there, but also, I mean, the visual art that they've put in and commissioned and both from the previous collections and the TC Steels that they have up to the new art is very cool. I mean, obviously there's a whole sense there of looking at, you know, different creative ways to look at what healing is and what healing means. And how the arts are a part of that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's a very cool thing. I'd love to hear the work that you guys brought along with you. Adam, would you want to
start? Sure. It's a little longer of a poem if you have a 3 minutes
ahead,
or
man.
So. All right. I won't preface this. This is about a very famous poet from the modern age in the 20s. It was part of modernism, and here he goes. So much depends upon a red wheelbarrow, glazed with rainwater, beside the white chickens. The Red Wheelbarrow by William Carlos Williams. You may have seen this poem before, in a textbook or tacked on a classroom wall, some bathroom stall even, scratched in black ink, funny little words to wash your hands of at the sink. So much depends upon a red wheelbarrow, glazed with rainwater, beside the white chickens. When my high school teacher read these words, I blinked back at her, cocked my head like a spaniel, swiveling a smirk toward what she said was true poetry. Now, what I didn't know then is that William Carlos Williams was a physician and spent his days road tripping Route 9 visiting sick kids and delivering babies. And when he had to wait, as doctors often do, he'd pull a notepad out of his pocket and scribble-scroll all the images he'd seen. You see, Williams believed there are no ideas but in things, and one day, if you believe these stories to be true, he sat with a brittle girl while watching the morning dew at the window, her steady breathing punched by his typewriter hitting the page, clickety-clackety, clickety-clackety. She's gonna hack it, she's acting much happier, knows how to hack it, she's coming back from it. And Williams had a feeling he didn't know how to explain, till he peered past the room to a scene through the window pane, a wheelbarrow rusted red in the rain, as lonely as a broken chariot, and chickens flattering like fattened doves, waving like a white flag in cannon fire. The scene was a ripened plum plucked out of a dream and explained perfectly. The weight in his heart, in the room, from your start to your tomb. So much depends on what you give, on what you've seen, and how you've lived, and it's true. Because poetry depends on you. So much depends on how you smile, how you face fatigue with the grit of white teeth, how you grunt along with every single gain, like you've lassoed a bucking mare and have a cowboy grip on the rein. So much depends on every heave of your breath, how it's just a blessing for your family to see the rise and fall of your chest and your laugh, how sometimes you still grumble like a rolling thunder on a desert plain, a guffaw, a chortled snort, the flap of your jaw, and yes, some depends on how you cry, how you hide your tears sometimes when your family comes by, your eyelids like spilling fishnets trying to catch the thrash of the sea. From the fault in our stars, there is more to you than plastic tubes and scars. You are the details, the sparkle on the water at the edge of the day. You are a road-tripping physician, a poet who has learned how to pen roses between pill doses, who's learned to say, so much depends upon a red wheelbarrow, glazed with rainwater, beside the white chickens, and every moment you have at the window, the plot thickens.
That was awesome. Adam Henze, poet who's part of the Healing Project.
Thank you.
At Eskenazi Health and is part of their art program, and you're a great performer.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Mitchell Douglas, we'd love to have you wrap things up for us here, man.
Sure. This poem is untitled. In the turn of centuries, wounds of a country severed, paths to new millennia, optimism bristling in the marrow of a people, eyes forward, our needs, no matter age, equal. What do we make of history? Do the years forgive, the shouts of backs turned grow silent? If I offer my hands, know that I do so in honor, not pity. You may feel the water rising, know the danger of flood, all a body can lose. But when the waves fall away and the obscured is revealed, all that remains are deeds, cupped like hands for water, a healing vessel, and this peace I gift to you.
Absolutely beautiful. And that's the poem that's at the fountain, right?
Yes. Yes.
That's
yes. So you cool. See that the last two lines there are at the fountain.
That's lovely. Awesome, thank guys. You. Thank you both so much. Adam Henze, Mitchell Douglas, really appreciate you both coming into Art the Matter today. Great to see you both again.
Thanks so much.
Appreciate it.
This was great.
Travis DiNicola with poets Mitchell Douglas and Adam Henze, who are part of the Healing Project at Eskenazi Health. You can watch some of their videos on YouTube if you search for The Healing Project, and you can find out more at eskenazihealth.edu. That's eskenazihealth.edu. You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio.
The ancient land and rich cultural traditions of the Southwest region of the United States fuel the imaginations of early 20th century artists like Georgia O'Keeffe. The IMA is currently showing Georgia O'Keeffe and the Southwestern Still Life, featuring more than 50 works that provide fascinating examples of art's capacity to capture the essence of a particular place. Sharon Gamble invited guest curator Harriet Orkel in to tell us more about the world of O'Keeffe and her contemporaries.
So, Harriet, Georgia O'Keeffe was born in Wisconsin. How did she develop this relationship with the Southwest? Tell us how she first got exposed to New Mexico in particular.
Well, she first got exposed to the Southwest because she became a teacher in Texas.
Ah.
And she was an art teacher. And she went to Colorado on vacation in about, I think it was 1917 or 16.
Mm-hmm.
And she, on her way back from Colorado to her Texas teaching place, she stopped in Santa Fe. Now, she didn't stay very long, but she developed an interest in it, and it stayed in her mind until she went back in 1929.
Hmm. And we have to remember that the Southwest was considerably different then than it is now, you know, not as built up, not as intruded upon.
You know, interesting enough, Taos is still not that built up.
Mm-hmm.
But at Santa Fe, where she was, yes, it's now much more modern than it was then.
I went there, and I have to say the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum, it's the fall of the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum. I got on their e-letter list. This is the power of art museums, I'm just saying. And I was like, I've never been to Santa Fe. I have to go there and see this museum. And I love that there are rules in the town about what new buildings can look like, and there's a Target that looks not like a Target store, but like an Adobe dwelling.
That's really the fun of going down there, right?
So it's one thing to visit a place and be intrigued by it, but it's another to kind of have it consume your work. Is there a kind of clear before and after point in her paintings and her drawings?
Yes, there is. And a lot of it comes from the fact that she was never an Easterner. That was never her forte. But when she went to visit Alfred Stieglitz, who was showing her drawings that he had seen in his gallery, she was drawn to him, so she settled in the East.
Mm-hmm.
But she was never happy. Too busy for her. Mm-hmm. Too all-consuming with people. Even when he went to his summer home in upstate New York, it still didn't feel comfortable for him. Mm. So for her. So what she wound up doing was she did paint the skyscrapers. She painted her first flower painting in 1924. But she married Stieglitz in 1924. Mm-hmm. And by 1929, she was pretty uncomfortable in New York. And she thought first she might go to Europe, but then she changed her mind. Then she thought she might go farther upstate New York and get her own place. Mm-hmm. But she had a friend, Rebecca Strand, and Rebecca Strand was interested in the Southwest. And so the two of them went together to the Southwest. And I won't say that at first her art changes a lot because she still concentrates on flowers, but eventually it's nothing like she did in New York because, of course, she's not doing the skyscrapers, so she's not doing the cosmopolitan area. She's focusing on the landscape of that area in Santa Fe.
Now, I'm trying to think if I've ever seen a painting by her of a person. Did she ever?
There are in her catalog, Raisonne, a couple, but mm-hmm. she never did. Yeah. That was not her focus.
It was the landscape.
It was the landscape.
Yeah.
Right.
Was some part of being uncomfortable in the East the fact that there was still this prejudice about, you know, you're not a real artist unless you live in the East and you went to Germany to study or you went to France to study?
I don't think that bothered her because once she met Stieglitz, she wasn't worried about being an accepted artist. Mm-hmm. He made sure she was, and he had the power to do that. She was most uncomfortable. Don't forget, she comes from a dairy farm in Wisconsin.
And she had a lot of siblings, right?
And she had a lot of siblings. Yeah. And she, you know, she teaches in Texas. She's never in a busy area till she gets into New York. Mm-hmm. And she doesn't like it. It's mm-hmm. just too much. She can't find any privacy. Uh-huh. You know, even at Stieglitz's summer home, had an extremely large family. And that family was there all the time, 20 people while she was there. She could not find a place to go. So the Southwest seemed like paradise to her.
Sure. It's quiet.
It was quiet. It was free from people if she didn't want them. And yet there were people if she did want them. So I think she really just felt like she belonged there. Mm-hmm. And when you think about where she comes from, she really did belong there.
Mm-hmm. Out on the equivalent of the Wisconsin Prairie, except a little different setting. So she ended up having a circle of fascinating friends, including poets and artists and theater people and so forth. And some of those folks are represented in this show as well, right?
Well, not the theater.
Not the theater people,
right,
the poets,
right.
but the visual artists, yeah.
Yes and no. I mean, yes, there are some of them that she was acquainted with, but a lot of the people that she invited to her homes there were people she met when she was at Ghost Ranch, which there was a wealthy owner of that particular property, and eventually she bought it. And those people that he introduced her to became her very, very close friends. And the artists that passed through her were probably not known artists. They were more people that came there to help her in a way or mm-hmm. just to, and she mentored them a little bit. But the artists that she would have known, like Marsden Hartley, who mm-hmm. was down there, came from Stieglitz.
Okay.
So there were several people that, you know, came down there that she would have known from the East. But her most friends were not the artists that you would see in the exhibition.
I am kind of fascinated that Victor Higgins, who was born in Shelbyville,
yes.
is in this exhibit. We've got an Indiana boy.
Yes, yes, yes. Yes, because he was a member of the Tahoe Society of Artists mm-hmm. in Tahoe, New Mexico. Mm-hmm. And he was drawn there for sort of similar reasons, because he just, remember, we're in the East and things are becoming very industrialized, and the Southwest feels like America the way it used to be, instead of having the forests run over by construction and, you know, taking away all the lands that they could have that they were painting. So they go to the Southwest, and that drew everybody. And Higgins was one of those. And if you look at the works at Higgins in the exhibition, they're very traditional. But we have one called Mountains and Valleys of that area, Tahoe's, you know, mm-hmm. landscape. But it is quite abstract.
Hmm.
So what is happening is that there's a lot of modernists who come to the Southwest because in looking for something different to paint, looking mm-hmm. for some different cultures, different landscape, different lighting, different colors. And even though the Tahoe Society of Artists is mainly traditional, there is that influence that comes in there, especially if they travel between Tahoe and Santa Fe.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Was Ghost Ranch a horse ranch originally?
No.
It was
the kind of ranch where people stayed.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Right. And originally, Georgie O'Keeffe stayed in the 20 rooms that were available. Mm-hmm. But one day she got into her car, drove down there, and she said, she's there. And the man who owned it said, well, why did you not tell me? Well, I'm here now. Find me a room. So what happened is he finds her. He gives her his home at Ghost Ranch to work in.
Wow.
And that is the one she buys in 1940.
Wow. And it's still an artist retreat, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yes.
So for people who don't think every day about Georgie O'Keeffe and they've just tuned us in and they think Georgie O'Keeffe, and the first couple of images that come to mind are enormous flowers or bleached bones. Were there others paint? I mean, bones, flowers, yeah. Everybody's painted flowers since painting evolved. But bones, is that kind of radical for her to do, to paint
radical
bones?
For any artist to
yeah.
do? Because if you look at the artists in our exhibition, I think we might have two other artists who use bones in their paintings.
Uh-huh.
But for Georgie O'Keeffe, who walked the landscape, the desert landscape a lot, she picked up those bones. And she just saw shapes. And she didn't see dead animals. She said that these bones were more alive to her than the animals that actually were walking. And that's because
wow.
they were part of the landscape she loved.
Mm-hmm.
And they did represent the Southwest, past and present. And she collected them. And in fact, one time she put it in a barrel and she sent them back to the East because she said she was going home. Remember, she goes back and forth because
right.
she's still married to
right,
Stieglitz
right.
until he dies. And there arrived this box of bones, and Stieglitz is wondering what she's going to do with them. But it does give her an opportunity to paint. And those bones are in the exhibition.
Now, she has to have some exposure during all these years in New Mexico to Native American culture. Is she influenced by Native American culture?
Not in
at
her
all?
Art.
Okay.
Not in her
That's
art.
That's intriguing.
She has one wooden Kachina figure, which is in the exhibition, which was at Mabel Dodge Lujan's compound, and that's where she went first because she was invited there mm-hmm. by her, and she had a studio there. And Mabel happened to collect these wooden Kachinas, and Georgie O'Keeffe was just fascinated by a Virgin Mary one, and so she paints it. But other than that, if you look at our culture artifacts, which mainly will show you Native American culture,
mm-hmm.
she's not in there. There's only a couple of paintings by her that is in there. Now, in some of her works, you might see a Native American pot rarely, but that's about as close as we get to her being influenced by that.
Sure. She's her own person with her own
style.
She
is. She has her own, yes, her own way of doing things.
In the range of years represented in this exhibition, what do you see happening? How does her approach or her style or her interpretation change?
Well, I think mainly she gets more influenced by an environment she had never known. Remember, she's never painted bones before.
Mm-hmm.
And she starts painting the front of her house in Abiquiu
mm-hmm.
and is enthralled by that black door. So the concentration is just on a black door. Of course, we have the front of the house in it too,
sure.
but it's just pared down to that door. So I think she actually moves away a little bit from flower painting, more into the landscape of the area, which she hadn't done in the East. So I think you're seeing, if you put the two, compare her flower painting that she did in the East and her architectural renditions of New York, forget that they're skyscrapers, they're entirely different in focus. She narrows to a more concentrated form rather than lots of little lights in the buildings that she painted. She is just into simplifying her art even more.
Hmm. Did she work in pastel, oil, acrylic? Did she stay in one of those?
She stayed mostly in oil painting. She did several drawings. There are some other mediums, but if you focus on what is shown mostly and what we think of her mostly, it's oil painting.
All right. The management and the board aren't listening to this. What piece would you take home to enjoy?
Oh, they can listen, because I would take home Jimson Weed, which belongs to the museum. Of course, I don't want them to listen too close, because I can't carry it out.
Pretty big.
There is a great story to Jimson Weed. Georgia O'Keeffe had been going to the Southwest, you know, from 1929, and she went every year till about 1932. Then she has a nervous breakdown, and that keeps her from going in 32 and 33. 34, she has an attack of appendicitis.
Ouch.
And she is really pretty depressed. She's beginning to think maybe she won't be painting again.
Ooh.
She gets this commission from Elizabeth Arden to paint this painting for her gymnasium that she's building in New York.
Mm-hmm.
So George O'Keeffe decides to paint the Jimson Weed, which has become a popular thing for her. It's a poisonous plant that blooms at night, and mm-hmm. she was enthralled by it. So she has a few paintings in her area that she painted, that she brought back with her, that Stieglitz is trying to sell. So she paints that Jimson Weed based on some of those flowers and based on her memory. And when it's finished, remember, it's her largest flower painting, has more flowers in it than she's ever painted in another painting. And she calls it the Miracle Flower. And that was the original title of that painting.
Oh,
and the reason she calls it the Miracle Flower is because she actually painted it, thinking that she would never paint again.
Sharon Gamble with IMA guest curator Harriet Warkle. Though their conversation focused on Georgia O'Keeffe, the current exhibition, Georgia O'Keeffe and the Southwestern Still Life, features many works by her contemporaries as well, providing wonderful context for seeing O'Keeffe anew. You can learn more at imamuseum.org. Again, imamuseum.org.
Travis?
Sharon?
Time to the holidays is growing short.
Yes, and, it's and coming
we,
upon us.
We have only a short calendar today, but we'll give you some ideas for presents and things to do during the holidays on our calendar we call
What do we do? I know, I've got some shopping I've still got to get done.
So do I.
Yes,
what
okay.
do you got?
one of my favorite events every year is when the Baselli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra plays at the Jazz Kitchen for their holiday concert. And this year it is taking place this weekend on Sunday, December 14th, two concerts at 6 and 8:30. And it is their 20th anniversary doing this. And that is a really, really cool thing. Tickets are $25 at the door. And they are also going to be taking donations with proceeds going to the Julian Center. And it is just an awesome evening with Mark Baselli and Brent Wallrab and Owl Music Group. And they will be doing some amazing music. And maybe if you're really lucky, you'll get to hear Everett Green sing Silent Night.
Woohoo.
Yeah,
we usually run into each other there,
mm-hmm.
don't we? That's a,
yeah, it's a great
highlight
show.
Of my holiday season. If you have somebody a little naughty on your list, here's something you might want to get for him or her. They should probably be at least 17 or 18 for this present. Ooh.
Wow, what's that?
Wow, what is that? Tickets to A Very Phoenix Xmas 9 Flashing Through the Snow, which is kind of like a cross between contemporary theater and old school variety show with singing, dancing, usually some tapping, and some very funny sketches about all the winter holidays and sometimes even beyond that. A Very Phoenix Xmas 9 Flashing Through the Snow plays
flashing
through December.
Through,
I know,
you just,
right?
You can't help singing.
You can't help but sing it. Yeah, but it plays through December 21st, but you want to go to phoenixtheater.org or call them at 317-639-7529 pretty quickly, because those tickets go fast.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Hey, here's a great gift idea for people in your family who love magic.
I love magic.
well, there you go. So the Indianapolis Winter Magic Festival, the fifth annual, is taking place in January, January 22nd through the 25th at Indy Fringe. But they have teamed up with The Illusionist, which is the direct from Broadway show featuring a whole bunch of incredible professional magicians that's going to be performing at the Marat from January 20th to the 25th. Why does it? Well, it all comes together because it's all happening at the same time. And if you go to the Indy Fringe website and buy your tickets, you can get special packages where you can get tickets to The Illusionist as well as tickets or full passes, depending on which package you want to go with, to the Winter Magic Festival as well. So it's going to be a whole week of magic, both local and national and international, with tons of performers. You get more information at the Indy Fringe website about this. And I'll tell you what, you will save lots of money by going through these packages.
Hey, Pam and Bobby or Michelle, did you hear that? I think that might be something on Travis's wish list. Hey, here's something for somebody naughty or nice. Indy Writes Books, a book lover's anthology, a beautiful hardcover book featuring contributions from 29, count them, Hoosier authors, all the way from John Green to Dan Wakefield to Kathy Day, Ben Winters, Barb Shoop, Will Shortz, and as they say on radio, many, many more. Find out more at indiereadsbooks.org or just go to their store at 911 Mass Ave, because you're sure to find presents for everybody on your list. And we won't tell if you buy something for yourself.
No, no, not at all. What a great idea. Hey, if you're looking for something a little bit different from maybe a nutcracker this holiday season, then you might consider The Wizard of Oz, which is live on stage at the Civic Theater from now through January 3rd. And it is their holiday tradition up at the Tarkington Theater, The Wizard of Oz, through the Civic Theater.
And don't forget the traditional A Christmas Carol at IRT, where there's lots of magic.
Oh, I love that. It's such a great production this year.
But also, if you want to do something a little bit different, Comedy Sports is doing its famous late night show with A Christmas Carol Unscripted. Audience suggestions and crazy, crazy twist and turn on A Christmas Carol. Find out more at Comedy Sports, spelled with a Z.
Hey, speaking of IRT, last thing, Velveteen Rabbit is also playing there at the IRT, and because it's been so successful, they've added four extra performances. So if you thought you wanted to go and were afraid you were going to miss it, well, they've got extra performances on the 19th, 20th, and 21st. Check out the IRT Live website for more information.
Fabulous.
And Sharon, I think that's all the time we've got.
Do I have time to say you can learn more about local arts events at indiearts.org/guide, the Arts Council of Indianapolis's Indie Arts Guide. Go there and learn much more.
Very good. And we'll be back next week with that calendar we call
What Do We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
Benjamin Harrison was the first president to have a decorated Christmas tree in the White House, and his home in Indianapolis reflects his fondness for celebrating the holiday. The Benjamin Harrison Presidential Site offers Christmas tours, White House Historical Society ornaments, unique holiday Christmas events, and much more. Travis DiNicola spoke with the organization's new executive director, Charles Hyde, about holidays at the Harrison home.
Charles, welcome to Art of the Matter. Great to have you here.
Well, thanks so much, Travis. I'm delighted to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
You're very welcome. And happy holidays to you.
Likewise.
Yeah, and we'll be talking in just a minute about all the great things going on at the Benjamin Harrison Presidential Site for the holidays. But before we jump into that, I first want to congratulate you on your new position as president and CEO at the site.
Thank you.
It's just been since this fall, right?
Yep, just since the beginning of September.
Excellent. So you were at the zoo before. This is a different beast, so to speak.
Very, very much so. But I've been very fortunate. And the different not-for-profits that I've worked for in the city, I was at Conner Prairie for 8 years, and most recently at the zoo for 7, and have had just such a great experience. We have such a great arts community in Indianapolis, and I've had a lot of great support, and have had a number of very, very strong mentors that have helped me on the way, and you know, have Just been delighted to come to the organization and to be with the presidential site.
Well, the presidential site, I mean, it's unique. It's the only one in Indiana, of course. And I mean, there's a lot of responsibility in maintaining that and in dealing with the curation as well as the education. Tell me a little bit about that and sort of your vision for how this is going to play out for the site.
Well, as you noted, Benjamin Harrison is America's Hoosier president, mm-hmm. and we have the only presidential site in Indiana pertaining to Benjamin Harrison. And the site itself is very remarkable. It's really a testament to the care that has gone into the site from the very beginning, you know, from the time that it was acquired from the Harrison family to today. And the house is in immaculate condition.
Yes.
It's a truly remarkable collection with over 10,000 artifacts. Just have a superb board, have a great staff, really great supporters. And so it's been a great experience for me coming into this organization. And obviously it's a big learning curve, but just so delighted with the opportunity. And I think that as an organization, there's just so much potential. I'm very excited to help it be successful.
And there's some, you know, and the house itself is beautiful, and then of course great grounds and the programs that that take place there, and of course the house is at about 12th and Delaware, downtown Indianapolis, and you know I know kid groups come through there all the time as part of you know school tours, and of course you get tourists, but the home has a lot of other things. I mean, any listener of Art of the Matter knows I've been involved in the croquet tournament for years, which is always a lot of fun.
Thank you.
But there's theatrical events that go on there. There's different dinners that have taken place. All types of sort of interesting things that go on at the site.
Well, and I think really the important thing to see with the presidential site is that it's more than a house museum. It has such great potential. It's done a number of great events like you've mentioned over the years, but it really has such great potential to be a living, breathing civic center.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much more to that Harrison legacy that we can help people make those connections and make those civic connections within Indianapolis specifically, but also within our larger community in Indiana and even nationally. And I think that really that's where our potential lies, is we've done so much so well, and mm-hmm. we'll continue to build on that legacy as we go forward and making the presidential site even greater. So I really feel like, and this is a big, bold assertion.
Go right ahead. That's what we do here in Art of the Matter.
I think that we really have great potential, that we can be the most innovative, the most impactful, and the most civically engaged presidential site in the United States in the next 5 years. And you can't just go around saying things like that. You have to have more to it than that. And I understand that that's not going to be an easy task.
I'm sure you're working with your board and staff right now on planning for the future and how this is all going to unfold. We do, I think, should mention that your predecessor, Phyllis, was just an amazing leader and really, you know, put a great house and site into your hands.
Well, kind of playing off the house, we do have a great foundation, mm-hmm. and that's what we intend to build off of.
Oh, there we go.
So we've got a really strong, enthusiastic board. I'm just so proud of our staff and the mm-hmm. work and effort that they've put into it. Phyllis has certainly left a legacy of her own that has really brought the presidential site to this point where we continue to build off that legacy as we move forward.
Excellent. Well, Charles, again, congratulations on all of that. You want to talk holidays?
Oh, I'd love to. I'd love to talk holidays.
Let's talk holidays, because there is a lot going on. What would you like to start with? Because, I mean, I know you've got, of course, the special tours, the Christmas tours, the mansion, that are going on now through the end of the year. But then there's also a lot of other events, too. Where would you like to start?
Well, let's start off. I like to run things sequentially.
Sure.
Now through the end of the year, we have a presidential Christmas. And so those are daily tours of the presidential site, of the home itself. And you actually get to tour through the home. It's decorated for the holidays as the Harrisons would have enjoyed it in the Gilded Age.
Mm.
And Harrison was well known for having been the first president to have a Christmas tree in the White House.
Oh, right. I remember hearing that before, yeah.
And so we play off of that legacy, and you get to see how the Harrisons would have celebrated the holidays at that time in their home.
That must be a lot of fun to decorate for that.
Oh, it's spectacular. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you really have to see it. And there's so many idiosyncrasies to the Victorian age with their decorations. And as you might imagine, it's probably maybe a little more decorative than than is the current style, but that makes it all the more interesting and all the more of a picture of an age. And it's one of the neat things that we can really do with the presidential site. It's we can use the house itself, which of course was the Harrison's, and you may be aware of this, but 80% of what you see in the home is actually original to the Harrison family.
Yeah.
So it allows us to uniquely present the Harrisons in a picture of that time period.
Now, do you actually have original Christmas ornaments that you're able to use? Or?
We have an assortment of original and reproduction items that we're able to interpret the holidays. As you go through the house and as you see the supporting exhibit, you will see original items
so cool.
to the family and certainly to the age. So it, again, allows us to interpret that. But it's one of the things that we're doing more broadly is it's not just looking backwards. That so much of what we can share and the reason that we are a valuable institution is that we can use the lens of the Harrisons.
Yeah.
Not just to look backwards and understand the past, but also to look forwards. And so using that lens of understanding. So it speaks to the past, but also how we understand our current age, how we got here, and what to look forward to with the future.
Nice. Very good.
So,
well, it sounds like just a great place to visit for the holidays and see the way that the house and the tree are decorated. Great way to celebrate on a nice snowy Indiana December day.
Well, as family traditions go, if it's not your family tradition already, it's a great place to start.
Great place to start with.
And that's kind of a point of entry into the presidential site. You know, you can just, you know, enjoy a nice relaxing tour, enjoy the holidays, bring your family. We have other events, though, for the holidays
that can
kind of give you a deeper look.
Some specific ones. One coming up this weekend, Saturday, December 13th, the Live Family Christmas.
Yeah, with the Live Family Christmas, it's actually we have interpreters that are portraying the Harrison family. And so you not only get to see the decorative elements that would have made for the holidays for them at that time, but you also get to see them celebrating Christmas as a family.
Indeed.
And so getting to see them interact, hearing them talk about that Christmas tree in the White House, it just really makes for a lot of fun. So
cooking
that's
the dinner meal.
Exactly. So you get to bring your family to spend a little bit of time with their family.
That's very nice.
Yeah.
So, and again, that is the Live Family Christmas on December 13th. And then you've got the Candlelight Tour of Delaware Street coming up on December 18th.
You know, this is one of our signature events, and it's one of those really neat ways to get engaged in the community. You know, it's a presidential site. It's of national import, but we value strongly our local roots and the fact that, again, Harrison was a Hoosier president. He was elected from Indiana. Yeah. And to him, it mattered that he was on Delaware Street. So that's where many of his closest connections were. It's the people that he spent time with. He really took Indianapolis as his adopted hometown.
Yeah.
And so Delaware Street is significant, both from that Harrison connection standpoint, but also from us as an organization and wanting to partner with other organizations in our community.
That's a beautiful street and beautiful homes. And then you've got organizations like the Indiana Humanities and Harrison Center for the Arts just down the street from you. And yeah, there's a lot going on down there.
Well, and that's what we do with the Candlelight Evening is we provide a boutique experience. And, you know, looking at us as an organization, we're never going to be looking to have attendance like the Children's Museum or like the zoo where they have over a million.
It's a different type of experience.
Yeah,
sure.
It's really more of a boutique experience. And so with an event like this, with a Candlelight Evening, it allows you to come in and you get to go inside those houses. You drive past every day and
big,
you just
gorgeous houses,
you just really want to get inside and have a closer look, whether it's the University Club, whether it's the Indiana Humanities Building.
Yeah.
Those are gorgeous buildings, and they were the homes of very prominent community members, turn of the century. And so you get to come inside, have cocktails, stand in front of the fire with a nice drink. It really makes for a great evening. You get dinner at the University Club.
Oh, that's great. So you do need to make reservations for that. Of course,
reservations are needed for the for that event, for our family Christmas or for mm-hmm. the presidential Christmas, certainly you can come day of. But mm-hmm. the candlelight evening is going to sell out. So I'd highly recommend making
reservations
as soon as you can.
And of course, people can do that at presidentbenjaminharrison.org as well. I do want to mention that you know, people may not think of the Harrison presidential site as a place to do their holiday shopping, but in fact, it could be. Right.
Oh, I mean, please, please come check out our gift shop.
Yeah.
But we do have ornaments from the White House Historical Association. Really unique items that I'm certain you're not going to find anywhere else.
Yeah.
So it's if you want to find the perfect thing for your friend or family member that loves history, great place to go. If you're also just looking for something unusual or unique, great place to go. Come check us out. So
excellent.
And of course, to visit the gift shop doesn't require admission. Just, you know, let them know at the door you're there for the gift shop and you'll be able to step right in and have
very
a look
good.
Around.
Travis DiNicola with Charles Hyde, Executive Director of the Benjamin Harrison Presidential Site. You can get more information at presidentbenjaminharrison.org. Once again, presidentbenjaminharrison.org.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Vaselli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m. when I'll chat with the new director of the Heron School of Art and Design Gallery.
I'll take a look at the new A Craftsman's Legacy TV show seen on WFYI 3.
And I'll check out a collaboration called Artville. Plus, we'll have that arts calendar we call
What Do We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.